Excuse me. First, I'd like to thank Sammy for encouraging me to submit an abstract and to attend the CDC immunobiology study group. It was a wonderful experience, too, and it's really made me, I've been studying chlamydia pathogenesis for over 15 years using animal models, and it's really nice to begin to take what we've learned from animal models and address human disease. And that's what I'm going to try to convey to you today in the next 15 minutes. So my talk is on the pathogenesis of genital chlamydia disease, and I'd also like to try to reinforce how important it is that we understand the key mechanisms involved in pathogenesis, because they do have great impact on control efforts, whether they be screening and treatment efforts or efforts towards vaccine development. So as you know, chlamydia is the most prevalent bacterial STD in the world. And although the majority of infected individuals are asymptomatic, in women, genital infection can lead to severe sequelae. And all of these sequelae occur at the level of the oviduct. Ectopic pregnancy, premature delivery, reduced fertility, and infertility. And because this infection can ascend and infect the oviduct and cause disease there, this is what results in the morbidities associated with this infection. And indeed, as we just heard, repeated infections are common because the immunity that develops after infection does not protect from reinfection. And these infections are associated with an increased risk of disease. So somewhat unique to chlamydial infection in the female is that the site of disease at the site of the fallopian tube or oviduct is somewhat removed from the initial site of primary infection. This organism, after sexual intercourse or exposure, invades the endocervical epithelium and then spreads canaliculi up the uterus to invade the endometrium and finally to infect the fallopian tube or oviduct, where inflammation and then subsequent scarring leads to obstruction of the oviduct and the morbidities of infertility and potential for ectopic pregnancy. This is a picture of a pathologic specimen from a woman who was infertile due to multiple episodes of PID. Here's the ovary. You can see that this oviduct would clearly not allow the passage of an ovum or an egg through the oviduct. This is a scarred down portion, and then here's the hugely dilated section of the oviduct that we call hydrosalpinx. This is another pathologic specimen from a woman who had high titers of antibody and multiple documented infections to chlamydia. And if you dissect this portion of the oviduct, you can see that the normal fimbriae that allow propulsion of the egg down the oviduct have been destroyed, and leaving the oviduct dilated and non-functional. So clearly, since the oviduct is the vulnerable site of tissue infection, one of the important questions that we need to answer is the timing of oviduct infection. How long does chlamydial infection have to last before it ascends to infect the oviduct and cause disease? And what are the factors that determine ascension? Well, in our laboratory, we focus on the immunological factors that perhaps prevent ascension of infection at the oviduct. And we actually, a few years ago, have discovered that certain mouse models that are genetically deficient in certain immune response genes are actually able to sustain infection without developing pathology and are protected from pathology upon subsequent challenge, thus suggesting that if we develop the right kind of adaptive immune response, prevent infection from the oviduct from happening, that we can actually develop a vaccine that prevents disease in humans. So what happens when infection occurs? Well, much of our information comes from animal models, and the histologic sections I'm going to show you come from our mouse data. This is a cross-section of an oviduct, and you can see these little pink globules are inclusions that contain replicating chlamydial organisms. This inclusion is ruptured and infectious elementary bodies are spilling out of the cell to go infect other cells. This is a cartoon of what's occurring. You can see that what happens is because this organism lives in the cell begins to recognize it, it begins to replicate, and the host cell itself sends out inflammatory proteins called cytokines or chemokines, which then induce recruitment of inflammatory cells to the site of infection. And as the infection proceeds, more and more inflammatory cells are brought to that site. This is a mouse oviduct at around 11 days of infection. And included among these cells are neutrophils and more adaptive cells such as T cells and B cells. And then with time, more and more inflammation occurs. And these inflammatory cells release enzymes and proteases that can destroy the epithelial cells and the surrounding tissue. Once the infection resolves, everything is cleaned up, but you're left with a scarred down oviduct that leaves the female patient infertile. So here's a list of some of the cells that invade the tissue. Innate immune cells include natural killer cells and neutrophils, monocytes, and macrophages, and then also adaptive immune cells that begin to recognize the organism specifically, such as T cells, B cells, and antibody-producing plasma cells. Well, a question that we ask in our lab frequently is, are some of these immune responses primarily protective, whereas others primarily pathologic? If we can separate out the potentially protective response from those that are pathologic, then perhaps we can develop the recipe for an effective vaccine. Well, years ago, Richard Stevens and his lab discovered that if they took chlamydia and infected female genital tract epithelial cells in vitro, that indeed those cells secreted cytokines and chemokines that were very effective in recruiting inflammatory cells. And thus, Dr. Stevens coined the phrase, the cellular paradigm of pathogenesis. I think there is ample data now to support the fact that the infected host epithelial cell is indeed the key initiator of this entire process. It follows from this cellular paradigm, though, that perhaps the entire inflammatory response as a whole leads to pathology, and perhaps we can't separate out pathologic responses from those that might be protective. Well, evidence for the cellular paradigm of pathogenesis lies first in the fact that, indeed, these epithelial cells, when they're infected, secrete cytokines and chemokines that can bring in inflammatory cells. And more recent data actually shows that a cytokine called interleukin-1 can actually induce direct damage to the tissue itself. And also, if you look at human biopsy specimens where the infected cells are, you'll see multiple inflammatory cell types, neutrophils, T cells, plasma cells, are all present at the site of infection, suggesting that the inflammatory response as a whole may actually lead to pathology. Furthermore, murine and monkey data indicate that the degree of infection correlates with the degree of cytokine and cellular response, and this also correlates with the development of disease. And furthermore, earlier or more effective antibiotic treatment in mice and monkeys leads to less disease. But there are evidence against the fact that all of these cells cause disease. For example, most infected humans do not develop oviduct disease, and indeed, genetic variants in immune response genes have been associated with protection from pathology, suggesting that, for example, a certain female may develop a prominent neutrophil response that leads to disease, whereas another female may develop a prominent CD4 T cell response that protects them. And furthermore, there's significant data in human immunoepi studies as well as murine vaccine studies showing that the stronger the CD4 T cell response, specifically that of interferon gamma production, the more protected that female is. But to make it more confusing, the T cell response may actually serve a double-edged sword, in that there are times when maybe the CD4 T cell response is not protective, but actually leads to pathology. This is developed because there was the potential that CD4 memory T cells reactive to specific chlamydial antigens that are induced upon initial infection may respond in increased numbers upon repeated exposure and induce pathology. And this paradigm, the immunological paradigm of pathogenesis, really stems from data of repeated infection in monkeys and guinea pigs, where indeed these animals that sustain repeat infection have worse disease than animals that were infected once. And upon repeat infection, what you see is a rapid influx of T cells, CD4 and CD8 T cells, in very large numbers into the site of infection. However, problems with this model include the fact that monkeys, in some of these studies, monkeys were inoculated in salpingeal pockets. There was actually oviducts transplanted into the abdomen of the monkeys, and there was direct inoculation of the organism there, so that the animal really doesn't have the chance for their T cell response to protect the oviduct from infection. Furthermore, no pathogenic chlamydial-specific antigen has been identified. Years ago, it was thought that chlamydial heat shock protein may be this pathogenic antigen, but actually more recent studies have shown that vaccination of guinea pigs with chlamydial heat shock protein can protect them from pathology rather than induce pathology. And once again, the vaccine studies in mice and human immunoepi studies in showing that the stronger the CD4 T cell response is, the better off the mouse or the human. In fact, in studies in patients with HIV, there is an inverse correlation, the number of CD4 T cells and the incidence of disease in those patients that are at high risk for exposure. So how does this impact chlamydial control programs? Well, if you consider the cellular paradigm, where the tissue-damaging immune response is elicited by the infected epithelial cell, what comes from that is that infection of the oviduct is a prerequisite for disease development. And thus, if we can prevent oviduct infection from occurring, we can prevent disease. Thus, control programs should seek to provide treatment before infection of the oviduct occurs, or to shorten the duration of the oviduct infection as much as possible. Now, the problem is how to determine if oviduct infection is actually occurring. Furthermore, it may be that if upon a primary infection, where a woman has never seen this infection before, thus they have no adaptive immune response develop, it may be that upon primary infection is when a person is at greatest risk for oviduct infection. And thus, prevention of primary infection may be key to prevent disease. However, if we consider the immunological paradigm where the T-cell response may actually induce disease upon repeated infection, then control programs should work hard to prevent repeat infections and to identify and treat patients with chronic infection where ongoing T-cell responses may be happening. Perhaps even more important are the implications that these paradigms hold for vaccine development. For if we consider that prevention of the oviduct can lead to prevention of disease and a CD4 T-cell response may prevent ascension, then those of us who work in the laboratory need to discover adjuvants, the chlamydial antigens, that will promote a very strong CD4 T-cell response so that we can develop a vaccine to prevent disease due to this infection. And if that's the case, then induction of sterilizing immunity at the level of the cervix will not be required. In fact, infection of the cervix will be fine as long as the T cells can prevent infection from ascending to the vulnerable tissue site, that of the oviduct. However, if even a minuscule amount of infection at the oviduct can lead to a robust anamnestic CD4 T cell response that causes disease, then developing a vaccine is going to be very problematic because this is an intracellular bacterium, and thus antibody responses are not very effective at preventing infection or controlling infection due to chlamydia. Thus, in this case, a vaccine that induces strong T-cell immunity may actually be harmful, and sterilizing immunity will definitely need to totally prevent infection to prevent disease due to this organism. Well, what are remaining questions and potential approaches? I think first and foremost, a question that we need to answer is the T-cell response solely protective? If it is, then we need to go after it. We need to go after developing a strong T-cell response to prevent disease due to this infection. We also need to know the timing of oviduct infection and disease and the factors that determine ascension or prevent ascension of infection to the oviduct. Through determining those factors, we can identify high-risk individuals and thus focus our prevention efforts on those groups. Well, how can we determine the answers to some of these questions? The availability of multicolor flow cytometry, I think, is a unique tool that allows us to not only determine what cell types are present at the site of infection and disease, but what those cells are making, and thus what are the exact mechanisms, molecular and cellular, that lead to disease development. We can use genital tract tissues from established animal models, and we're actually very fortunate to have good animal models to study this disease process. We can also use human peripheral blood, endocervical brush, and even endometrial biopsy samples, thanks to some of our obstetric gynecology cohorts that can acquire these samples from patients, and determine the specific inflammatory cell types that lead to or prevent disease. Finally, we need to continue our research in immunoepi, immunopathologic, and genetic studies, and correlate data with infection and disease outcome. Some of the results that have already come from these studies are the data that I mentioned, that in sex workers that are highly exposed, a CD4 T cell response is very protective. And then there's multiple studies of genetic factors showing that differences in immune response genes may lead to protection from a disease or an increased risk for disease. So already we're determining potential factors that put people in higher risk groups. And I'll stop there and thank you again, Sammy, and entertaining questions.
Are there any questions? Okay, go ahead.
In reference to time to treatment, you were saying the question is how many days does the community infection have to last before ascending to infect the OPDA? Because the answer is we don't really know how many days that'll last, so we just need to make sure people are treated as soon as possible. Or do we have a time frame and idea? Is it within 7 days? Is it within 14 days?
Well, I think some of the epidemiologic data that was presented here today gives us a hint that if you're developing PID, then probably your oviduct is infected. So I think that's helpful that, you know, maybe 3% of people develop infection of their oviduct within 2 weeks of presenting with infection. And it's going to probably vary depending on the symptomatic nature of the infection and if they're adolescent patients versus adult patients. Clearly, in the adolescent patients, repeated infection is by far and away the norm. So these girls really don't have any lasting immunity early on in their sexual debut. Well, since we don't know, it's probably there the entire time. So the question is, does it ever, once it goes to the oviduct, does it come back down? Since the place where chlamydia loves to live is the cervical epithelium, it's probably there the entire time that it would be present in the oviduct. Unless perhaps, as Will mentioned, this phenomena of aberrant forms, where the chlamydia kind of hides out in a way. We definitely need to know if that really happens in humans. It clearly happens in vitro, but we've really not documented that to occur in animal models, and it's never been documented in humans.
There's a lot of new data about epigenetic mechanisms regulating inflammation, CD4s, various interleukins, etc. So one possibility to look at your models is to see which genes are turned on or off genetic gene production.
Can you just repeat the question?
So I don't think that was really a question. It was more of a comment that, epigenetic reasons for disease and other models have need to be explored in this model as well. And I clearly think that's important. And we've talked about some of those in this recent review that's going to come out. One of the most important is the mannose binding lectin that tends to inhibit chlamydia infection has been shown. Genetic polymorphisms in that protein have been shown to alter pathology in women with chlamydia infection.
Thank you, Dr. Darville. Okay.